From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. We are just over 4 months into the Trump presidency, and already the White House communications director has resigned. And there are rumors that a larger staff shakeup is on the way. Joining us now is NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Hi, Ron.
Hello, Jeremy.
And what do you make of the timing of Mike Dubke's resignation? This is the White House communications director. And could it signal more changes?
Yes, it very likely signals more changes. Mike Dubke actually resigned almost 2 weeks ago, but agreed to stick around until the president had returned from his 9-day trip. And obviously, there was a lot of work to be done back here in the White House while the president was away, and so much news interest in everything that he was doing and saying. So he stuck around for a couple more weeks. So really, this is something that's been in the works for a while. He never really got into the gears of the originals, as they're called, the people who were with Trump a year ago, 2 years ago. He was more somebody who was seen as operating as an insider in Washington. So he hasn't really acculturated and was always a bit of a round peg in a square hole.
Is there likely to be a larger staff shakeup? I mean, we've heard rumors about Reince Priebus and Sean Spicer and even Steve Bannon.
Yes, all those people have been rumored to be on their way out, and they've also been rumored to be rising in terms of their authority within the White House. This is the war of White House leaks. When we hear something about Reince Priebus being on the outs, it's probably not coming from Reince. When we hear something about Steve Bannon looking for another job, it's probably not coming from Steve Bannon. But you're hearing these warring leaks from the different camps within the White House, and that contributes to a lot of this confusion. But we're also hearing a lot of talk about a war room, so-called. That would feature some of the people from campaign days who have fallen out of the Trump world, people like Corey Lewandowski, who was campaign manager at one time, David Bossi, who was his deputy. And these are people who are known as fighters, counterpunchers, people who might go after the media. Not that the White House has been all that pacifistic about the media up to now, but the expectation is that things are going to get rougher.
And what about Jared Kushner, the son-in-law of President Trump and senior advisor to the president? He's moved to the center of this story as well. He's alleged to have tried to open a secret back-channel communication with Russia during the transition. What does the future look like for him in the White House?
His father-in-law, that is to say the president of the United States, is still backing him. He sent out John Kelly and H.D. McMasters over the weekend to stand four square behind Jared Kushner and say he had done nothing wrong. Now, John Kelly is the Homeland Security Secretary and H.D. McMaster is the president's national security advisor. So having them out on the Sunday talk show saying everything was fine with Jared was a pretty good sign that the president was standing behind his son-in-law. But what he has done, or what we are told he has done, is not only to talk to one guy named Sergei Kislyak, the Russian ambassador, but another guy named Sergei Gorkov, who is listed as a banker in the current Russian hierarchy, but has also been a spy and is also a very close associate of Vladimir Putin. So why he and Jared Kushner were having secret talks, that interests people.
And I think you turned the national security advisor into high definition, Ron, H.R. McMaster, not H.D. McMaster.
Sorry.
I know. It's
Excuse
hard
me.
With these two
Excuse
letter
me. I do understand. And he certainly is a vivid person
very
in
vivid.
The administration.
High def. Okay. Well, we're expecting to hear from, or we were expecting to hear from the FBI, the former FBI director, James Comey, on Capitol Hill this week. That's been delayed. Do we have any idea when he might testify?
Probably in the week after. We don't expect this to be an indefinite delay. We expect him to be up when the Senate is back in action, and that certainly is going to be something we're all looking forward to.
Now, Trump promised to replace James Comey before leaving on his trip to Europe and the Middle East. That didn't happen. Do we know when a new FBI director could be chosen?
It could be at any time. Some of the cast of characters here have been changing. We did have a lot of expectation that Joe Lieberman was on the short list, maybe even the shortest of lists, a list of one. But Joe Lieberman is no longer under consideration, has withdrawn himself. And perhaps there have been others who have come to the top of the list and risen to the surface and now are going to withdraw. But it could happen at any time. The administration knows that it needs a change of subject. And this would be an excellent way to distract everyone from some of these Russia connection troubles.
Hmm. What about the Paris Climate Accords, Ron? Are we likely to hear President Trump address that this week and decide whether the United States will stay in the agreement or leave?
Well, of course, the United States is pretty much alone in trying to absent itself from this global agreement. And we were told over the weekend, when the president would not commit to joining with the rest of the world, that we would get a decision finally as to which way the president was going to go this week. It's Tuesday. We've still got a few days to go. We'll see if we get that result this week.
Finally, Ron, are you hearing anything in Washington about the relationship with Europe after the German Chancellor Angela Merkel said basically that Europeans are going to have to fight for their own future, that that's how she felt after President Trump's visit to Europe?
The president himself has fired back on that front, Jeremy. He has said that Germans are very bad on trade, that they have a huge trade surplus with the United States, a deficit for us, and that we're going to change that, and they're not going to get away with not paying for the full support of NATO that he thinks they should pay for, even though they're not actually under any contractual agreement to do so.
That's NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Ron, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, a question for you. What happens when teenagers from two very different neighborhoods in Washington, D.C. get together to talk about where they're from and race? It's part of a project run by a teacher who hopes it will help bridge D.C.'s expanding racial and economic divide. Michaela LaFrac from Here and Now contributor WAMU was there when students from one predominantly black school and one majority white school sat down to get to know one another.
120 teenagers pack into the gym at the Murray School, a majority white private school in Northwest Washington, D.C. They sit in clusters, waving at kids they know and eyeballing the ones they don't. Murray teacher Io Magwood stands in front and welcomes the visiting students. They're from Cesar Chavez Public Charter School in Southeast D.C., where 83% of students are black and the rest are Hispanic. This event is Magwood's brainchild. It's part of a year-long program she thought up during the contentious presidential campaign.
I was very concerned whether young people would be able to grow up and be able to talk across difference and understand each other.
Washington, D.C.'s schools show evidence of the city's racial and economic disparities. A study from the University of California in Los Angeles this year found that over 70% of black students in D.C. public and charter schools have virtually zero white classmates. Cesar Chavez has no white students. Earlier this year, students in the exchange program went on a joint field trip to the National Portrait Gallery. Magwood remembers how one Cesar Chavez student reacted.
An African-American student said, "I just want to say something. I have never spoken to a white boy before, but you are cool. You guys are cool." And so they really enjoyed meeting each other, but I was just struck by the fact that many of these young people have zero contact with each other.
At this event, the students start by breaking into small groups to introduce themselves. The tone is pleasant, but a little awkward, as you'd expect from any group of teenagers who don't know each other that well.
My name is Imani.
My name is Brianna Washington.
My name is Callan.
I'm Owen.
Then they get into the big stuff. One group gathers around a picnic table on Murray's sprawling front lawn and dives into an hour-long conversation on race and privilege. Murray 10th grader Journey Hairston and Cesar Chavez 11th grader Angel Anderson talk about how the city feels segregated.
Differences are okay, but like since we make people like benefit from the differences and like we put people in bad places because they're different than others, that's when it becomes a bad thing.
I don't know. I just believe there's no such thing as race. I believe it's just a label.
Murray sophomore Callan Daniel and Cesar Chavez junior Angel Johnson discuss the differences between some of the city's neighborhoods.
Just like getting out of your own neighborhood can sort of show you, at least even if you don't speak to anybody, it can show you the differences.
Because I know a lot of people from Southeast that are like really nice and they don't do like a lot of bad things, and not everybody is like that, and not everybody up here is like bougie because like your guys are nice. You just gotta like see and try to like experience it, because you never know like who you're gonna meet. Like everybody has a different story.
The conversation is a little stilted at times, especially when they talk about privilege, but there's one thing they all agree on: Donald Trump.
No one likes him. Anyone that doesn't say it.
No Republicans in my school. I don't even know any Republicans. The day I meet a Republican, I'm gonna give that person a hug.
Like the Republicans that have said that they're Republicans at Murray, they're like, they make sure to draw this distinction that they don't support him.
As the conversation wraps up, Cesar Chavez history teacher Elizabeth Genesco says she doesn't want to draw any grand conclusions about the program's success just yet.
It's difficult to tell right now. I know that, like, the actual test of how this went is years down the line, months down the line.
Moraes Io Magwood agrees. She says she knows this one program isn't going to solve the city's vast racial segregation, but hopefully it's a start.
You just have to chip away at it and hope that other people are chipping away at it too, and hope you're moving at least in the right direction.
Soon it's time to say goodbye. The Moraes students go back into their building, and the Cesar Chavez students load into two big white buses to head back across the city to their own school. For Here and Now, I'm Michaela Lafrak.
I once had a chance to visit composer Aaron Copland at home. He was in decline, but still, what a treat. We asked him to play something on the piano, thinking maybe a little fanfare for the common man. And in a way, that is what he played. He launched into Sondheim's Send in the Clowns. Perfect. Copland had an ear for popular culture. Here's one of the best examples of that from the wartime 1940s. Now, didn't that make you just sit right up? It's Aaron Copland's Rodeo. He wrote it for choreographer Agnes DeMille and the Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo, which moved to the U.S. during World War II. Copland is often called the Dean of American Composers, but he grew up in New York, a city kid. He said that like every American, he grew up with a sense of cowboys and what the West must have felt like. Our classical music lover, Fran Hoffner, has been thinking a lot about Copland. She writes a classical music column for The All in her own no-holds-barred, we often have to censor her voice. And so for people who are saying, oh, Copland, I've heard that a million times, Fran, you combine the fact that you were listening to a lot of Brahms and watching Fast and Furious movies to conclude you needed some Copland?
Yeah, so I had spent sort of the first quarter of this year reading this giant Brahms biography, and I was listening to a lot of Brahms, and I love sort of that late romantic German classical music, but it is really heavy and very intense to listen to, and it had been like over 2 months of only Brahms, essentially, and Wagner and the Schumanns, and I was watching Fast Five, which is the fifth Fast and Furious movie, for work. which should tell you a lot about my job, but there's a line The Rock says where someone gives him sort of like, do you want the good news or the bad news? And they give him the good news first, then he goes, okay, so give me the damn veggies. And I just loved that quote. It made me laugh so much, even though I'd already seen this movie before. And I was like, I've had 2 months of this German classical music. These are my veggies. And I wanted to just like move on with the dessert.
Mm-hmm. Or as you say, brownie sundae stuff, I kid you not. Aaron Copland's Rodeo. Look, you know, as you write, while it's Dvorak we credit with the invention of an American sound, Copland perfected it. I mean, this jazzes you so much. Me too. Why? Yeah. What about Copland?
I mean, it's just so easy to listen to and so fun to listen to. And it really is meant to be enjoyed by the masses.
Well, let's listen to some of the opening movement, Buckaroo Holiday. Hell yeah.
Yeah. It's so much fun.
But let's remind ourselves, I mean, what is he describing here?
So this was written for a ballet, and it's basically this, it's about a cowgirl, this sort of headstrong female protagonist in this ballet. It's very classic Americana, as you said up top. It's meant to sort of inspire joy and strength, and I think it does so in such a beautiful way.
And here we hear one of the most, as you write, de-effing lightful trombone solos in the history of music. ¶¶
It's so playful.
Yeah. I mean, it's, as you write, the trombone's time to shine.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's also just heartbreaking music in the choral nocturne. Talk a little bit about the sound.
The choral nocturne is very sweet. It's very sweet and wistful. I think I describe it as sort of like a night out on a porch in August, in that sort of end of summer nostalgia kind of mood. It really breaks up the excitement of this ballet in such a nice way. It sort of paces out your emotional connection to it and lets you catch your breath.
Well, it's also, remember, it's wartime. So there is a lot of, there are a lot of empty chorales, you know, at this point. And Copland initially said he didn't want to write another cowboy ballet. He'd already written one called Billy the Kid, which we're grateful for, also gorgeous.
I mean, Billy the Kid is so great, but Rodeo just has so much more emotional depth to it. And as fun and as it is to listen to, I think does have this sort of undercurrent of loss of what America was for a time. And it might be kind of a, you know, put upon nostalgia for the piece, but it does sort of reflect maybe that mid-war attitude of why can't things be the way they were.
Yeah, yeah. You love Leonard Bernstein, but this recording is Leonard Slatkin at the Detroit Symphony because it includes the third movement of Rodeo, which isn't often included. And as you say, I kid you not, it's called Ranch House Party.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, ragtime.
Yeah, I just loved getting a little bit of piano in there. Reminds me of Joplin, and it is sort of, it almost feels a little bit like an intermission between sort of the first two halves of this, but I do like it, and I think, I didn't originally even know about Ranch House Party until I was researching Rodeo, and now I sort of don't want to hear it without it. It does feel incomplete to me now if I don't include this little bit.
Well, now we move on to Saturday Night Waltz. Your favorite section. Explain why.
I just am so moved by it every time I listen to it. I think it does capture that very, you know, tragic mid-war attitude of yearning and love. And I think it's really earned by this point in the ballet. Like, he's had his, like, fun in Buckaroo Holiday, and even just coming after Ranch House Party, this is such a paced-out, beautiful dance. And, I mean, it's still a waltz. It's not particularly slow or, you know, it's not an adagio or anything like that, but it does have this drawn-out, moving melody to it.
You say this shows Copland is as great as Brahms.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think he really does get at the depth that Brahms was really yearning for in some of his darker and moodier pieces. And I don't think just because something is popular or catchy means it can't always have the same depth.
No. All right, in the final movement, everybody just pick up something nearby and get ready to bang on it because you can play too for Hoedown. Let's listen. Sounds like an orchestra warming up.
Yeah, I love that part of the beginning. It almost has to, like, catch up to itself.
Yeah. There's the woodblock.
I love that woodblock. And sawing on like the cellos and the basses is so fun.
When you see a good performance of this, they are having fun.
Yeah.
And you played percussion, so for you.
Yeah, I've played this hoedown movement.
Yeah.
Only.
And it's fun.
Yeah, it's super fun. I got to play the xylophone part for this, which is such a blast.
Well, there's everything. Triangles, snares, as you write, crash cymbals, woodblock, xylophone. There's a trumpet, solo, clarinet. It seems simple, but what are we hearing that's uniquely American here?
Just the unabashed sort of joy in it. I think a lot of sort of the European artists I've like gone back and looked through were trying to capture bigger things about progress and fate and love, but in a way that tortured them so much that it made a lot of their music occasionally very miserable. Beautiful and interesting, but no doubt very sad to listen to. And this has such an sort of unleashed, unbridled joy.
All from the imagination of a kid from the city.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that.
That's Fran Hoffner. She writes the classical music column for The All with her deconstruction of Aaron Copland's Rodeo. Fran, thanks so much.
Thank you.
There's a good chance that the last time you booked a hotel room or a flight, you used a third-party reservation service like Priceline or Expedia. Online travel agencies drove nearly $100 billion worth of hotel bookings last year. That's according to travel industry researchers. And now, according to the Wall Street Journal, hotel chains are launching a marketing blitz to try to get some of that business back on their own websites. For more, we're joined by the Wall Street Journal's Jason Bellini. Hi, Jason.
Hi, how's it going?
Going well. And, you know, these third-party sites typically take a cut of each booking, and in exchange, hotels get a big flow of new customers. If that arrangement has worked so far, why are the hotel chains so eager to change it?
Well, it's because that cut that you mentioned, it can be up to 25%. So big numbers. And Hilton's chief marketing officer told the Journal that it's time to be aggressive. And in that effort, Hilton's launched an advertising campaign to try to persuade guests, and then it's under the title of Stop Clicking Around and Book Through Hilton's Website or App. And the other major hotel chains are trying to do the same, trying to get people to change their habits and convince them, oh, maybe the cheapest way to get a book a hotel room isn't necessarily through these third parties like Expedia, Priceline, the others. You know, and those other sites have been, you know, growing fast. I think that's why they're concerned. Priceline's total room night reservations last year rose 25%.
Is there any sign that the marketing blitz from these hotel chains is working?
It's hard to say because it's early on. But one caveat we should add to these discounts that they're offering, they're offering these exclusive discounts to members of their loyalty programs. And the reason why is because the contracts that the hotels sign with third-party websites usually prevent them from offering lower rates on their own sites. And the hotel chains say, well, okay, we are free to offer discounts to members of our loyalty programs. And the hotels also started offering discounted rates at roomkey.com. That's a travel site that several of them own. So I guess if you can't beat them, join them.
Well, how different is this for hotels than for airlines, which also you can search for airlines on these travel websites like Kayak?
You can, but the main factor here is that there are far fewer airlines than hotel chains. And also, you know, especially if you're traveling in Europe, there's lots of smaller hotels. It's true in some parts of the U.S. too. So that's why, you know, in particularly in the international market, that's where these chains are concerned, is that people are really going to first and foremost the, you know, your Expedias, your Pricelines.com. But it's a different situation for them. And the margins aren't quite as high with airlines as well with third parties.
Well, just in the few seconds we have left, I imagine it's going to be tough to get people to change away from a model where they can comparison shop and go to the hotel website directly.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Hilton's chief executive vice president for their chief commercial officer said that they're right now just trying to educate customers, changing their behavior and get rid of the perception that you get the best price when you book through one of these third-party channels. And then, you know, they're doing things like allowing people to use their points towards Amazon.com and Starbucks gift cards. So get people into the loyalty game. Yep. That's what they're really hoping for here.
Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal, thank you.
You bet.
Remember a few years ago when reports of huge islands of ocean junk began to surface? The most famous was called the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, said to be miles of plastic bags and cups and fishing gear all enmeshed, floating across the sea. Well, scientists have downplayed the idea of actual floating islands, but they don't downplay the huge problem of ocean plastic. And great brains have been racking, trying to come up with a solution. Now, a 22-year-old Dutch inventor says he has it. Boyan Slat founded the nonprofit The Ocean Cleanup in 2013. With the help of a viral TEDx talk, he's raised a reported $31 million, much of it from very high-profile investors, including Salesforce CEO Mark Benioff and PayPal co-founder Peter Thiel. He's organized 30 vessel expeditions to research ocean trash and unleashed 65 engineers and staff to design a system of booms to collect it. Now, there have been critics. Marcus Erickson of the Five Gyres Institute worries about the effect on marine life of these booms. Others said Slat and crew were initially stubborn, didn't listen to science. But they have adjusted their design and this month announced plans are on track to start this ambitious project next year, 2 years ahead of schedule. Boyan Slat joins us by Skype from Delft in the Netherlands. Boyan, what first inspired you?
Yeah, so when I was 16 years old, I was diving in Greece and I realized I came across more plastic bags than fish and thought, yeah, I'll clean this up. And that for me started this mission to invent a structure that could actually clean this up. And now we recently announced we can indeed do so and in just 5 years' time.
Well, and you first gave a TED talk about this 6 years ago. You were 17 at that point. But there was this perception that there were these floating islands of garbage. We now know that it's much more below the surface of the water, this huge amount of plastic that is in the ocean water. So have you had to adjust the system? Tell us, first of all, about your system, kind of booms that would bring the garbage in.
Yeah, so indeed, at first it was the world had a perception that it was sort of a solid mass of plastic. And hence, in the past, people proposed to clean this up with boats and nets. But the thing indeed is that it's very much dispersed, the plastic. It's not a solid mass. So doing so would cost many thousands of years and tens of billions of dollars to complete. So what I proposed was to, instead of going after the plastic, we let the plastic come to us. And over the past 4 years, our team has been developing a technology that uses very long floating screens, which are in a U-shape. And what we do is we attach to this U-shaped boom, we have a suspended anchor, which is at a depth of about 1,500 to 2,000 feet. And what's the case is that the deeper you go in the ocean, the slower the current gets. So at the surface, it's quite fast. And then the deeper you go, the slower the current gets. And by suspending this anchor in this deeper water layer, we are able to slow down the system enough so that the plastic moves faster than the system, hits these barriers, and then gets concentrated. So in a way, we let the natural ocean currents do the hard work for us. And now we've been able to show that with a fleet of 50 of such systems, we should be able to clean up about half this Great Pacific Garbage Patch in just the next 5 years.
Because you're hoping that we know that the plastic gets to where it is because it's carried by currents to five regions of the ocean known as gyres. These are, you know, natural gathering points for marine debris. And you will then work with those currents to get that plastic to come into your catch-all. And then what, have boats go out to the area where you're catching the plastic and pick it up?
Indeed. So about once a month, a vessel visits each of these cleanup systems, almost like a garbage truck of the ocean, would bring the plastic back to shore where it would then be processed and recycled into new products that we would then sell at a premium, of course, because we could sell it as being made out of ocean plastic. So there's this branding value to this material.
Okay. Well, as you know, there's huge interest in your idea, but also a lot of concern. There are a lot of scientists and ocean researchers who worry that these contraptions that you will put out in the water, which are not tested yet, will not be able to withstand, you know, nature's fury, and they'll become part of the garbage, you know, that's floating out in the ocean. But others ask, you know, what about trying to get the plastic on shore, the conservation groups that have collected tons of garbage right from the beaches, or get it right offshore? Baltimore has a water wheel that catches tons of waste right there in Baltimore's harbor. You know, what about this idea of, instead of this untried, perhaps risky idea, get the plastic at its source?
We're happy to acknowledge that, you know, it's a high-risk, high-reward project, and certainly it's not easy, but we're confident that with the right team, right now we have 65 scientists and engineers on staff, we work together with the best offshore engineering in the world here in the Netherlands, that we are able to make it work. And of course, it's very much experimental right now. We're doing the tests, but through those tests, we hope to get to something that will certainly work. Mm-hmm. But having said that, of course, we also need to prevent more plastic from entering the oceans in the first place. But that is not a substitute to cleaning up plastic from the deep sea, because once in those offshore accumulation zones, the plastic doesn't really go away by itself. With our expeditions, we have found plastics really dating back to the 1970s even. So once it's in those gyres, it doesn't go away by itself, and it also gets more harmful over time. So all these large objects, they fragment down into these smaller and smaller pieces, becoming as small as that they would then be able to be consumed by fish and other wildlife, which is, of course, a very dangerous thing. So by cleaning up what's already out there, we also, in a way, prevent the creation of these microplastics. Right now, just 3% of the plastic in the oceans is those small and hazardous microplastics. But this will, of course, become 100%. So it would multiply 30-fold if we wouldn't clean it up. So I think we really need to do both. We need to both stop it at its source and clean up what's already out there.
Right. Well, even some of your critics, and one of them is Nancy Wallace, who's director of the Marine Debris Program at the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, say, look, a lot of the garbage is way too far down in the ocean. It's again, not what we think, this floating island. But even she says it's so great because you've got people talking about this and thinking about this and thinking, you know, will it work? And if not, how can we improve it? And I'm wondering, do you ever sit back and reflect, wait a second, I'm 22. If I understand this, I don't think you completed school.
Yeah, so after half a year of aerospace engineering in college, I indeed dropped out to do this full time.
Well, why not? Because, you know, you've got people backing you and you've got a dream and a vision. But do you ever find yourself thinking, how did this happen? I'm 22.
Well, I think I've always had my projects throughout my life. And you know, for me as an inventor, you know, having an idea, seeing that become reality, there's really no better feeling than that. And of course, I hoped that we would get to the point that we would be ready to start deploying a first cleanup system in the ocean. But I never really realized how much of an effort it would be to get to this point. I think I sincerely underestimated that, and probably for the good, because if I would have known how much of an effort it would be to get here, I would probably have been quite intimidated and not have started this. But yeah. But we're here now, and hopefully we'll get to the point that the oceans are clean again as well.
That is the benefit of youth. Boyan Slat, founder of the nonprofit The Ocean Cleanup, planning to install their system to clean massive amounts of plastic out of the Pacific Ocean next year. Boyan, we'll stay in touch. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
And now a note, the new Wonder Woman movie will debut in the U.S. on Friday.
You will train her harder than any Amazon before her.
Five times harder. 10 times harder.
Never let your guard down. You expect the battle to be fair.
Until she is better than even you.
The latest Warner Brothers movie based on a DC comic character focuses on Diana, who lives on a remote island, a paradise inhabited solely by women. So the Alamo Drafthouse cinema chain in Texas thought, how about women-only screenings in Austin and New York? This is the first big-budget movie focused on a female comic book character in a while, and it's directed by a woman, Patty Jenkins, and some of next week's women, or people who identify as women-only screenings, have sold out. But critics on social media are saying things like, if you had guys-only screenings of Thor 3, there'd be an uproar. Well, meanwhile, there is also a move to ban the film in Lebanon. The actress who plays Wonder Woman, Gal Gadot, is Israeli, and Israel and Lebanon have had decades of conflict. Lebanon's Ministry of Economy is seeking the ban, but a theater in Beirut is scheduled to show the film tomorrow with free popcorn. Stay tuned. It's Here and Now.
Have you heard of poppin'? It's a dance craze that started in Fresno, California. Well, a new oral history project at Fresno State is documenting the roots of poppin'.
People young and old, hey, what do you say? The hippest trip around is coming your way.
Reporter Alice Daniel takes us through the history. First off,
Soul Train, the hippest trip in America.
Flashback to 1979. Don Cornelius, host of the syndicated TV show Soul Train, has just announced the next act, the Electric Boogaloos.
How about it for him, gang?
Five dancers, all dressed in black with silver stripes, silver bow ties, silver shoes. Cornelius gets their names. The stars all hail from Fresno, California.
Okay.
Sammy Solomon, alias Boogaloo Sam, specializing in Boogaloo.
Oh, good.
Timothy Solomon, alias Poppin' Pete Poppin.
Poppin' Pete demonstrates his moves. He makes his body jerk robotically.
Okay, as you may know, these very creative young men have invented a dancing style that's becoming very popular, and it's described as popping or boogaloo or...
The crew performs to the funk band, the Barquets.
Here we go.
The Electric Boogaloo's appearance fueled a poppin' dance craze. Poppin' Pete even worked with Michael Jackson on his Thriller video. Deborah McCoy was also dancing in West Fresno in the 70s. She grew up around Poppin' Pete and Boogaloo Sam, and she and her brother Ken were a dancing team. They traveled the state pop-locking and roboting.
I remember we danced at an Armenian church. They called us at a church.
Wow.
That's when we were put on the record. We were like, okay, back in the day, dance and church did not mix.
Right.
I don't care who you were. Did not mix. You going straight to hell.
McCoy's talking to historian Sean Slusser, whose new oral history project will be archived at Fresno State. Slusser and his colleagues are collecting photos, video, flyers. They're hoping to build Fresno's hip-hop narrative by interviewing anyone who identifies with the culture. Graffiti artists, MCs, DJs, hip-hop dancers including b-boys, lockers, and of course, poppers.
That they're using hip-hop the same way, right? It's a way, it's a vehicle of expression. It's a way to kind of, you know, get through economic depression and get through all the kind of problems that we associate with cities.
Deborah McCoy is one of the first participants to be interviewed. She says her family didn't have money, but they still managed to wear fabulous costumes. Her stepmom was a seamstress.
We would go to the thrift stores and buy material. She would sew all of our clothes.
Slusser asks her where she learned her dance styles.
From the street.
Yeah. Hey,
what do you mean? What do you mean, where were we learning? On the street. There was no going. Are you kidding me? I have to say it like this.
Yeah.
You're black and you're going to go take dance lessons? Come on, dude. It's on the street. It's right there. That's how that they were called battles. There was no fighting and all that. You want to fight? Okay, we're dancing.
Let's go down.
Like McCoy, the Solomon brothers practice popping at a city-run community center. The historian Slessor takes me to the building. It's now a Head Start school.
Yeah, this was a space that they would come to and practice. So they would develop routines that they would then do in kind of local talent shows.
The Electric Boogaloos were pioneers, he says, but popping's exact origins are still up for debate.
One story that's kind of emerged around Boogaloo Sam was that he was in church, in a Baptist church here in Fresno, and that kind of scene, like the sanctified women who, you know, caught the Holy Spirit and would move and dance and kind of spasms and whatnot, that like that was kind of in the back of his mind, looking to develop a new dance.
And there's a competing origin story. It revolves around a kid named Ticken Will, who danced with the Solomon brothers early on. He lived in Fresno's Tulare Housing Project and created moves like the old man, imitating a man walking down the street with a cane. Over the years, hip-hop in Fresno evolved. In the 90s, dance battles involved kids whose parents were refugees from Laos after the Vietnam War.
Everybody always talks about Fresno when it comes to b-boy in the Hmong community.
That's James Vang. He grew up in a rough area in the 90s and stayed away from gangs by breaking. He says Hmong b-boys made a name for themselves in Fresno and then spread out to other states.
So they brought that b-boy history with them over there to start dancing. And now you got b-boys in Minnesota, North Carolina, Wisconsin.
That history and how it influenced future generations is just one of the chapters Fresno State hopes to document next for its oral history archive. For Here and Now, I'm Alice Daniel in Fresno.